This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of the Rerooted Podcast here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. I'm Francesca Maxime. You can always find out more about me and my offerings and my anti-racism resources on my website, MaximeClarity.com. The Buddha's invitation, if you will, the mindful invitation to see clearly what's really going on. And also, in our rerootedness, to kind of, you know, find our center as we dip into this process of clear seeing, which can sometimes feel unmooring, kind of can sometimes feel a little bit overwhelming, but necessary, I feel, as a path to walk through or to walk on or toward, so that we don't skip ahead and we're not spiritually bypassing to some place where we feel as though, as we begin to do anti-racism work, that we are just sort of resting in this place of we're all one and we're all connected, which of course we are. But my guest today is going to talk a lot about the ways in which there's been systems over and over again of ways that try to divide and conquer, as opposed to, as Haney Lopez talks about, unite and build. So our guest today is Dr. Jacqueline Badalora. She's written a book called Birth of a White Nation, the Invention of White People and Its Relevance Today. Its second edition will be coming out in Rutledge soon. You can buy this online now, or you can wait for the second one next year. Jacqueline Badalora was born in Edinburgh, Scotland. She lived in Antwerp, Belgium for 6 years before her family relocated to Victoria, Texas. And it was this experience of attending high school and middle school in Victoria that informed her understanding of race in America. While she is currently a lawyer and a professor of sociology and criminal justice at St. Xavier University, she's also a former Chicago police officer. She holds a PhD from Northwestern University and has been engaged in anti-racism training since the mid-1990s. Welcome, Dr. Badalora. Jacqueline, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for joining us on Rerooted.
Thank you for inviting me. It's really an honor to be here.
You know, the first thing I want to say is, I want to backtrack, and I just want to say, I want to acknowledge the land I'm on, the ancestral land, the Nipmuc land that I'm on here in Massachusetts. And although it can seem performative when I don't spend a lot of time just really unpacking that completely, I just want to at least name it and name gratitude for my ancestors also that brought me here from Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and from Italy. So just reading your book this summer, in the middle of the pandemic, in the middle of the uprising, in the middle of the protests, I'm doing this podcast with you on August 26th, and it was just a couple of days ago that Jacob Blake was shot 7 times in the back, unarmed, by a white police officer in Wisconsin. And this is after we have sort of had a reckoning of some sorts with the murder of George Floyd. And I'm wondering, how did we get here? And I feel like this book helps explain how we got here. So maybe just inviting you in to just sort of take stock of of this moment, knowing all of what you know, and then maybe we can unpack some of the specifics. What's happening right now?
Well, I think what's happening is we're seeing revealed through the actions of one particular institution, right? Law enforcement, which, and there are two, I think, fields where the enactment of our social problems is most visible and most extreme, because they leave bodies behind. And that's law enforcement and healthcare, right? Mm. And it's those two areas in society right now where we are seeing, one, the law enforcement part we are seeing because of these things, right?
Yeah, the phones. Cell phones.
Because without that, the narratives that whiteness have taught us would have dominated and formed what really happened, how those people really are and what they really deserved. But now the visual and audio and other parts that are captured are a disruption. Now the narrative that people of color have been saying for decades, if not centuries, is being revealed as a closer truth. And so in that case, the pandemic is what is revealing many social problems, but that is resulting ultimately in the death significantly disproportionate deaths of Indigenous people, persons of African descent, and Latinx. And actually, I just read yesterday, I was looking at the John Hopkins page where you can get so much information that Asians in the United States also have a higher infection rate.
Mm-hmm. Right. So these two places that are so alive right now, COVID and the uprising, the protests, really point to having certain populations that are non-white be more adversely affected.
Right. And why are they more adversely affected? And that's where my work, I think, comes in and helps shed light on what's going on. And I would really, I just want to be honest about what we call it. I don't usually go here on the front end. I usually wait till the back end. But it's institutionalized white supremacy. And it's nobody's fault. It was here before we all arrived. It's not even our parents' fault or grandparents' fault. It is a baked-in feature of this country, of every law and policy that has been birthed out of this country, is built upon a foundation of white supremacy. And that's what the law and history that my research tries to tell. It works to expose that and help people just understand. And if we come to the present moment and the uprising and the pandemic with the understanding of the multitude of ways in which white supremacy has played a role in allowing these two things at this moment to be played out the way they are before our eyes, it gives us a critical piece of understanding so we can do something different. But without that understanding, you know, I'm always so frustrated with an academia that we're sending these young people out to go, you know, and telling them, go solve these problems, go change law enforcement, you know, go change law. Without this sort of understanding of what got us here and how, you know, they just don't have the critical tools needed to really get us somewhere new.
You're talking specifically about the way in which law enforcement, police officers, men and women are trained and some of the things that they just don't know, they're just not trained in, that are just not shared.
Yeah, that's a piece of it. Truthfully, the whole institution itself, I mean, we're hearing questions and critiques of it now, defund the police and you know, which is kind of, nobody's quite sure what exactly that means. It's still kind of taking form as its own critique. And what I think is exciting about it is that it is calling on us to step out of this normative place, right? Our normative, taken for granted assumptions about institutions and how they work, and inviting us to imagine something different.
Hmm.
Right. And so I always think that, especially because what do we know about the institutions we have? Well, we know that they privilege white people, whether we asked for it or not, whether we wanted it or not, again, baked in, and disadvantage communities of color. And so it's time to imagine something new.
Yeah, beautiful. And just on that last point you just said, and it is that the privilege is there because the lack of access and opportunity and the disadvantage was baked in, meaning that there's more here because there's less available or given here.
It's a flip side of the same coin, right? So one side of the coin gives stuff to white people, let me just concretize that. Let's give a concrete example. So in the very first Congress of this country, had to establish all the laws of the United States, including immigration and naturalization. And our founders determined that in order to naturalize, which is the legal process one must go through to become a citizen when you're not born in this country, in order to naturalize a U.S. citizen, our founders said you have to be white. Okay, so again, baked in, founding law, lasted more than 150 years. So that immigrants who came to this country who were seen as white got this advantage, this access to citizenship, not because they knew something, not because they were better people, not because even they had the right religion, right? We had people who were seen as white, but who were Jewish, Muslim, and other faith traditions, got access. Whiteness was the requirement, whether male or female, whether rich or poor. So that's just an example of whiteness being conferring something. Okay, so that's one side of the coin. White immigrants who came here got something, whether they asked for it or not, whether they wanted it or not, it was baked in, a feature of law. And the other side of that same coin is that those who were seen as not white were disadvantaged, right? Excluded. And so what it served to do is to keep not... communities, people seen as not white, because who knows what white is, it kept them in a position of being cheap and dependent labor. So it was always serving the interests of the capitalists, the ruling elite. And in addition to that, it kept them subservient to the white people generally in a position below them.
Right. So much of what you're saying is just so important, and there's so many little places that I want to pause, because I want to underscore that what we're talking about is, you know, we're looking at a system that was constructed over time with things like the Naturalization Act that then created this place where certain people who had certain melanated levels were enabled to have citizenship for American citizenry, and that other people with whatever was deemed sort of arbitrarily, since race is a social construct, we can go back to Carl Linnaeus and the other folks who kind of came up with this idea, that this wasn't a thing until they made it into a thing for the service of this capitalist interest and division and whatnot. Because God forbid, if all the laborers got together and joined, then that would be a critical mass that would then be a threat to the smaller group of wealthy elite that were in power. And that's why this argument is always about power, equity, control, and wealth, and redistribution and reparations sort of seems to be not only opening of the heart as the end game, but also like, what does that look like? And to use your term, concretization. But I'm sort of bouncing all over the place with what I'm saying, but just sort of coming to mind. Can you, from the very beginning, you said, usually I say this at the end, but now I want to say it at the beginning. And you said white supremacy. When I think a lot of people hear white supremacy and they hear us as existing in a white supremacist world, I think a lot of folks feel like that has to do with neo-Nazis or that has to do with far right. And can you just further just sort of clarify what you mean by this being the system we're in, whether or not you like the term or not? I also use the term whiteness as a construct, as a series of systems, not that people with light skin are bad, but that this is a system of whiteness that is about suppression, about oppression, about a perceived superiority. So if you could just sort of do that, and then we can
move on. Well, as I said before, when I was hesitant to even use the language on the front end, look, when when you know the history of the emergence of this category of humanity called white people, and you unpack the laws, look, before a particular specific moment in time in colonial North America, if you look in the legal record, there is not one reference to anybody called a white person. You won't find it. It doesn't exist. And then at a very specific moment in time, you see bundles of laws passed in groups. And that's all, you always want to pay attention to those sort of events, right? Because it lets you know something big is happening. They're trying to cause or create a major change or responding to a huge threat. And so we see the assertion of now the people called white people for the first time following this massive rebellion that tied up the colony of Virginia for well over a year. But here's the important...
Bacon's Rebellion.
Bacon's Rebellion. Nathaniel Bacon led this huge rebellion, and it ultimately wasn't put down until the English sent in troops. I mean, it was huge. And what's important to note before I get to what happened after the rebellion is for folks to realize this piece. And this is something that when I lecture and share keynotes with audiences, people are most surprised by this particular bit of info. And that is this, that during the first three quarters of the 17th century, so until the late 1600s, persons of African descent and persons of English descent and other Europeans who worked on the same plantation were treated the same. They worked together, they ate together, they slept together. So daily life was experienced the same. There is a significant difference, and that is that persons of African descent were claimed by Europeans as enslaved, as property, and persons of European descent who were laboring on plantations were owned as well, but for a term of years. So they had an endpoint. And so that's, of course, a very significant difference. It also was not at all uncommon during this time period for there to be free people of African descent. And so we know from the historical record that the number one route, if you will, to freedom for persons who had been enslaved was they were able to purchase their own freedom. They had side jobs, and many had really valuable skills that they were able to use to purchase their own freedom and that of family members. The other way in which freedom could be realized was through the wills and trust of plantation owners who freed people they claimed as enslaved. And so, it was not at all uncommon for there to be free people of African descent. And free men of African descent and free English men and other European men, if you were free, you had the same rights and privileges as a matter of law. Mm. So what did that mean? That meant... free men of African descent could vote, and they did. They could hold public office. They could own enslaved persons of African descent, and some did. They could own indentured servants. Some did. And so you have to realize that context before shifting to what happened after Bacon's Rebellion.
Right.
And Bacon's Rebellion itself reflects the unification of people of African descent, European descent, of enslaved, indentured, small farmers. Like it was the masses of the people in the colony of Virginia were united. It would be nice to reference Bacon's Rebellion as this sort of historical model we could look to guide us, but we can't because the first phase of the rebellion was a complete slaughter of indigenous people that surrounded the colony of Virginia. It was the second phase that's a little more promising as something to look to as a model. And that, pardon me, is when they focused on the ruling elite. And what was happening right before the rebellion is that people began to be treated worse and worse, and plantation owners were trying to hold on to the people that they held as laborers because their labor supply from Europe had ended. That up until the 1660s, they had a readily available supply of human labor that could be shipped over, but that ended around the 1660s. Mm. And so panicked about how the work on the tobacco fields was going to get done. And so they would, for relatively minor infractions, they imposed these really long extensions on people's term of indenture, and did a whole variety of things to treat both enslaved and indentured laborers much worse. And so it was with out of that environment that Bacon's Rebellion erupted. And during that same period when workers found themselves treated much more harshly, a very small group was getting very, very rich. Mm. And so, that resulted in the clash.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's so important. And thank you for sharing that, because I think that people think that in some ways, like, it was always this way, or, you know, and it wasn't. It was more, I don't want to say it was more equal. It was more, I mean, it wasn't that it wasn't, there weren't problems, or that, you know, ownership of anyone at any period of time is, you know what I mean? We're not, it was more equal, and there was opportunity, that there wasn't those constructs around based on melanin level. You can or cannot be a human being. You can or cannot be owned.
Absolutely. I think we have come to treat it as inevitable, as almost as if seeing someone based upon their melanin level, I think we have come to treat or to perceive the treatment of people based on melanin levels as if it's something innate. And it just isn't. And history shows us that it isn't. Right. And in this country, our own history shows us that it isn't.
Well, what I think is so interesting, what you're saying is, and I was speaking with another clinician who works on sort of the way in which we as human beings perceive threat and, you know, sort of that othering and sort of tribalism that we've heard of. Maybe you would have people call it as a evolutionary negativity bias around, like, you know, if you don't look like, if you're not familiar to me and if there's uncertainty there, it's in my best interest from a very sort of lower brain, you know, fight, flight, or freeze kind of primal brain response to kind of like check you out, hold off, and not just be like, hey, of course, we're all just like peace, love, and hair grease. Like, we're just like, you know, like what, like, who are you? And I'm not so sure. And, you know, and that is sort of a thing that when married with this idea of this construction of one particular melanin level being better than the other one, and that it's the familiarity piece, it's the safety piece, right, that's missing, it's the unfamiliar piece, that creates then fodder for this system. And what I hear you saying, which is so interesting, is that it didn't exist.
No.
And part of it, I'm wondering, and this is just me sort of theorizing here, is that they all knew each other because they were all laborers doing the same work. So it wasn't like there was an other there, and there wasn't the construct of the melanin being the other, because they knew they were all stuck doing the same crappy work. And so there was a sense of unity and community in their horrible lot, if you will, as having to be these laborers that they were, that in some ways they could trust about one another. That I think perhaps...
I just wanted to add, I mean, I think today we're doing the same work, you know, but we don't see ourselves as the same because of what happened after Bacon's Rebellion and has been deeply institutionalized in this country.
Mm.
Right. So I don't know if it's doing the same work, because we're doing the same work today, right? Mm. I work alongside various melaninated people, but we have, because of whiteness, and how it shapes our lives and our perceptions, I think it causes us to have radically different understandings of each other today.
Yeah. I appreciate that 100%. So we talked about Bacon's Rebellion. We talked about the Naturalization Act, and there's other, you know, things that you really point to that are really critical. Noel Ignatius, you talk about him. Why is he important?
Well, Noel Ignatieff.
Ignatieff.
Yeah, I know it's a mouthful.
I'm butchering it. Sorry.
Okay. He'll forgive you. You know, he wrote this terrific book and a number of articles. The book title is How the Irish Became White. And what's so important about that story is that it helps to reveal that whiteness isn't even, if you look historically, hasn't even been about melanin, right? Because when the Irish Catholics came, they were not seen as white at the local level. And they weren't treated as white at the local level. And so they had to, his book tells the story of how Irish Catholics who began coming in the 1830s had to fight for their whiteness and how they did it. And that ultimately they did it on the backs of people of African descent.
Yeah.
It was by pushing themselves away from melanated people, especially those of African descent, that played a significant role in their success of becoming white.
Yeah. And I think it's so interesting because it feels like this rugged individualism, meritocracy, Western capitalism driver that we've been fed for so long, that there's something there in the psychology of what you just described with the Irish Americans about like aspirational, like I'm like white. Also, these people who are 1% billionaires or whatever the equivalent of a billionaire was back in the day, you know, like that I might be able to be like them, but you know, my lot is really still crappy because I'm really still a laborer, but this like this little one molecule of maybe seems to be part of what is fed and used even today.
It's true. I, pardon me. I often, in my classrooms, see that my, white students feel a greater affinity to like a Paris Hilton or a Melania Trump than they do to their Latinx or African American, Native American fellow student, you know? And so the power of whiteness to create links or perceived links where the reality of that difference is so huge is part of the power and the mirage, I think, of whiteness.
So interesting. That's there for you today. I'm just kind of just bouncing around a little bit. I know it's sort of disorganized, but I'm curious. I'm looking at the notes that I took in my book. Maryland law of 1681, first time legally used word white as a classification. You say this early on, and you spoke a little bit about it earlier, but that this was actually a law. And I think that you're a lawyer. And so it's important that like, you know what you're talking about, that like this was codified as part of what was legal in the US in much the same way that people think, oh, everybody has the same rights. And, you know, like, for example, Black women didn't really get the chance to vote until 1965. And a lot of people think that it was in 1920 and it really wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's part of that white people's experience defines American experience.
Right?
We have a long pattern of that.
Got it. And so this idea, and as you say that, I'm thinking of the canon of literature that, for example, you know, we were fed in college and like, who are we really reading and why? I mean, I happen to read a lot of James Baldwin and a lot of like Ray Bradbury and that kind of thing at the time and Foucault about power and equity. But okay, so what are some of the other critical laws in terms of punishments also, because one of the things that you talk about, and this is really getting into the heart of some of the really sticky, like, I guess, trigger warning pieces that I want to say for people, because this isn't pretty. And this is also stuff that if you know, it may help you know something with your left brain in an intellectual way, but it also may be so abhorrent to you as a human being that you may find that there's a shift in heart or belly around it that may feel like overwhelm or may feel like too much or it couldn't be. And you may even want to kind of not pretend like it's not true. But also I just want to name that up front and say like, there were laws that systematized, for example, and sanctioned and rewarded the rape of Black women for the, as you mentioned earlier, continued supply, as it was seen, labor for the landowner who was the rapist, and that there was no way out there in terms of children of a mother who was already being assaulted, and that's one huge piece. And then there's another huge piece where, like, if a white woman and a Black man were to be together, for example, that she would then become property or lose her citizenship and all of that. So can you talk about some of the ways in which legally this was all constructed?
Absolutely. So I want to tie it back up. So recalling that for the first three quarters of the 17th century, people of African laborers, anyway, of African descent and European descent working on the same plantation experienced life daily the same. And free persons of African descent and free Englishmen had the same rights and privileges by law. So then we have this massive rebellion led by Nathaniel Bacon, called Bacon's Rebellion. And it is ultimately put down, but only after well over a year and after the English sent in troops. And so we know that after the rebellion's put down, that, and we know this from the work of Theodore Allen, and he digs into the letters being written between the ruling elite in Virginia and the legal oversight authority in London, right? They have control over all the laws of the English colonies. Mm-hmm. And so the ruling elite in Virginia tell the oversight authority in London, do not worry, we have this under control. Because of course the folks over in England are not feeling very secure about their colonies at this point in North America. And so the folks in Virginia say, don't worry, we have this under control. And they indicate that they plan to pursue a divide and conquer strategy. And so it is in the decades following Bacon's Rebellion that we see for the first time the reference to anyone called a white person in law in North America. And when you look at the bundles of laws that asserted this group of people called white people, we see that white people were used to radically transform the society that had existed for 75 years. Mm. One where people of African descent and European descent on the same plantation were treated the same and once free had the same rights and privileges as a matter of law. That ended. And it ended through the assertion of white people. And when you look at the laws, in fact, let me concretize it. I'll give an example of a few laws that were passed on the front end. The very first law where we see a reference to anyone called a white person is in 1681. And it was actually an amendment to a law that sought to punish the first law said English and other freeborn women who marry enslaved Negro men. You have to remember there were roughly 8 to 12 men for every woman in the colonies of Maryland and Virginia. So women were a hot commodity. So you had these English women marrying in Maryland enslaved men of African descent. And so lawmakers wanted to stop that from taking place. And so what they did was passed a law that punished women who did so. And so it wasn't insignificant. So a woman who entered into such a marriage, she was enslaved for her husband's life, and any children that they have are enslaved. So the consequences were significant. Mm-hmm. And they explained that their intention in passing the law was to, quote, deter these shameful matches, end quote. The opposite, however, is what took place. Because imagine you're a plantation owner. What do you think of that law? It's awesome, right? Your property, as soon as she says, I do, your property value just went up. And and then should they go and have children, your property value goes up again and again. And so rather than deter the marriages, they increased. And so it's not until 1681 that lawmakers in Maryland amend that law. And this time, in this amended law, we see a reference to people called white people. This law punishes, quote, English and other white women who marry enslaved Negro men. This time, the lawmakers got it right, though, because this time they impose a punishment on anyone found to have encouraged the marriage. And they also imposed a punishment on the person who performed the marriage itself. Mm-hmm. And so Let me give a few examples of laws. That law would be called an anti-miscegenation law.
Right.
They are laws that made it illegal for white people to marry always a person of African descent. Every anti-miscegenation law passed in this country prohibited a white person from marrying a person of African descent. Some laws, like California's is one of the longest laundry list, they prohibited white people from marrying persons of African descent, Native Americans, Asians, Pacific Islanders, and Latinx all mm-hmm. were prohibited. And so, and those depended on the demographics of a particular region. So what we see after Bacon's Rebellion, don't forget, prior to this moment, the level of melanin didn't play a significant role in one's daily life and how they were treated if one were free. Mm. And so now that will never be the same, because what they did after Bacon's Rebellion was pass these laws that gave different meaning to groups. Mm. One called white laborers and the other not. And so a law was passed that required that a white laborer be paid certain goods upon completion of their term of service. Another law made it illegal for a person of African descent to be in possession of gun or powder. Another law prohibited white people from marrying persons of African descent and members of Native tribes, mm-hmm. men or women. This one, this particular law, wasn't restricted to women. The Maryland law was first only about white women, and then it was amended in the 1690s to prohibit both men and women. Mm-hmm. And then another law was passed that, and I want to spend a minute talking about this law, prohibited persons of African descent from testifying against white people. Mm. So you have to imagine, like, try to imagine you're in this time period, right? You're among the masses, you labor, and let's put yourself in the shoes of someone, pardon me, who is from England. Now you're being told you're what? You're a white person? What is that, first of all? And who is? You know that you are, right? Because the language of the law says English and other white. Sure. So we know that English, you count as one. But what does that mean, right? We know what English means, but what does white mean? Well, let's look at just that one law, the law that prohibits people of African descent from testifying against white people. What did they learn about what it means to be white through just that one law? Right? Yeah. It means you dominate. It means you can treat a person of African descent however you please without fear of prosecution unless a white person will testify against you.
Yeah.
And so what did people of African descent learn that day through just that one law? You better be passive and submissive to this new group of people called white people or else. Mm. And there's another even more sinister piece of this law that I want to raise up, because we're still living in the midst of it today, 2020. Yeah. And that is this. I'm going to again say the law. It prohibited people of African descent from testifying against white people. That law reveals that the law is aligned with the interests and perspectives of white people.
Right.
The law itself. Right? So drink that in and then think about where we are today. And that law that prohibited people of African descent from testifying against white people, we see that throughout U.S. history. People, Mexican people found themselves unable to testify against white people. Chinese, then Japanese, Asian people found themselves unable to testify against white people. And so this law was used, it clearly worked for the purposes of the ruling elite, or you wouldn't see it throughout U.S. history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love what you're saying, even though it's horrific and sinister, as you say, but I love the specificity with which you're breaking this down, because I think it can help us understand when people look at a Derek Chauvin and for 8 minutes and 46 seconds just sitting there, very nonchalant in the way that he is, like, literally, you know, sort of in the midst of what is a modern day lynching by, you know, knee on neck, and that it seems so cavalier and casual, and yet an entitled, there's that cooked in entitlement there piece, which, like you're saying, has been codified. So, and further reinforced, obviously, by the whole piece of being a police officer, but that also when you're talking about, well, you know, because there was a lot of conversation also at the time about, well, who are the people who were around? Who are the people who are watching? Who are the people who are witnessing this? And this idea of, you know, you've heard people say silence equals violence, and sort of this idea of being the passive bystander and what does it take to actually intervene, whether it's a frat house fraternity gang rape or whether it's something that's happening equally murderous or violent in the streets, as we saw, and what keeps people from doing that. And what you're suggesting here is that that seed was planted so deep, so long ago about protest, about, no, this isn't right, this isn't humane, that it becomes, I don't want to say easier, but more of the default to not step in.
Well, and I would push it even further. And I we talked about this in the green room before we started, about the fact, here's what, and I know this, and I'm happy to share something from my own experience about this awareness, but
sure.
I know that whiteness, this systematized dynamic interaction that plays out from the moment of one's birth in this nation, that positions white people above, is through all of our systems, through pop culture. I mean, it's everywhere. You think about the education that we have, and you know who's celebrated, whose stories count, and just the pervasiveness of whiteness. And so what being born into a culture that enacts whiteness every moment of every day through literally every institution, how that lands upon and shapes white people is such that it diminishes our humanity, right? If we begin our understanding of a healthy human being, at least a critical component of what constitutes a healthy human being,
sure,
is someone who has empathy, right? And so let me just share with you, if you don't mind, it'll take a couple of minutes.
But I love hearing stories. I think they're really, really evocative.
And I know now that I was able to get to this moment because of the work I was doing, the research I was doing. I absolutely know it opened me up. So let me quickly tell you a story. So I was in graduate school at Northwestern. I came home one day. I just wanted to check out. You know, I turned on CNN, which was the only 24/7 news at the time. And the journalists were covering a shooting on a Long Island train where about six white people had been killed. And so I was watching them, you know, talk to survivors and witnesses. And I was so sad by thinking about, you know, children who would never see a parent again, parents who would never see a child again. And I had tears in my eyes and I was really shaken for the rest of the evening. And I just kept thinking about how so quickly so many lives were radically changed and what a loss that was.
Mm.
And so I went about my next few days getting up, going to classes, doing my graduate school thing. And about 3 or 4 days later, I came home, plopped on the couch, turned on CNN. And on this day, the news was covering the killing of three people of African descent. And I got up and made dinner. And while I'm chopping and waiting for water to boil, I have, for the first time in my life, I realized that I had no empathy. I wasn't thinking about children who now had a parent not coming home, about parents now having a child not coming home. I had no tears in my eyes. I didn't have shit. I had nothing.
Mm.
And the crazy thing, Francesca, is that had you asked me if I cared about all people equally, a millisecond before I had that awareness, first of all, I would have been offended by the question.
Right.
Second, I would have answered loud and clear in the affirmative. And third, and perhaps most troubling of all, is that I would have believed it completely. Mm. But now I couldn't, right? Now I was shaken. I thought I was a good person. I did all the things that my society had taught me. You know, I volunteered, I recycled, donated, you know, I was doing things I thought made me a good person, but now I was confronted with this empathy gap And so I was very troubled by what I discovered about myself. And so I just started paying attention to my empathy when I had it. I realized very quickly I had a boatload of empathy for puppies and kittens and dolphins and turtles and polar bears and on and
right.
on. And I don't say that to mock that, because that is healthy and good. But when you contrast it with not having empathy for people based upon melanin, it helps, I think, helps us see how problematic and disturbing that is. Okay, and so I had this moment and I thought it was just me. I thought Jackie Battalora is damaged. Here's the other thing. As soon as I had that awareness, I knew right away I was not born that way. I knew it. I knew that something had been done to me. And I have spent my career figuring that out. And now I have a word for it. It's called whiteness. I didn't then. And so that's an awareness that I had. And so I thought it was just me. And then when I worked as a police officer, which I did after I had a PhD.
So interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is all related to this, actually. LaTanya Haggerty, unarmed Black woman, shot and killed. The next week, Mark Russ, African-American undergraduate student at Northwestern, unarmed, shot and killed through a traffic stop situation. And I couldn't shake. I thought the city was going to be on fire. And it wasn't, because the police officers were there. Themselves were of African descent. I think that was used to modify how people received it. But I couldn't shake it. And so I wanted to explore the system that kept doing this. And this was way before, you know, Trayvon Martin.
Right.
And so I went and became a Chicago police officer. So, but while I was a police officer, here's what I was part of and what I realized. So it was in the 1990s and early part. So I was part of the back end of the crack epidemic, right? And so crack addictions disproportionately impacted Black and brown communities. And how did we, the people of the country, respond, right? We demanded that our lawmakers be tough on crime. We actually demanded that our tax dollars flow into a militarized law enforcement and into building prisons to put people away. Jump to the 2000s. We have an opioid epidemic, and those communities disproportionately impacted our economically advantaged white communities. And how do we, the people, respond? As we see this as a health crisis.
Yeah, right? It's completely different.
Say lock them
it's
up.
It's a mental health issue. It's a substance abuse issue. Seek treatment,
because
give support.
That's because we see white people as human beings. And we do. And so I realized.
And entitled to help.
We have empathy for them. So we will help them, right? So what I saw in me, just me that one day, I began to realize is in my society. Yeah. That there is something wrong with white people. And we see that, we see what is wrong with white people reflected in US society all over the place. For me, I saw it most clearly through how we approached crack epidemic versus opioid. And you and I are seeing it, and listeners are seeing it all around us right now in this moment.
Right. And I really so appreciate the very specific human story that you have there around what you're calling the empathy gap, which I think is actually a really great, you know, sort of placeholder name, title, whatever, of what this really is about, right, at a core level. And I want to also just sort of like translate some of what you're saying into what I'll call mindfulness language, which is around the idea of that you came to this place of awareness. And when you had that aha moment of insight, as we would call it in Vipassana traditions or the Theravadan traditions, that it's this idea of sort of seeing deeply, seeing clearly, and that you were contemplative and reflective on that, but that there was a portal that opened and that it questioned your own own morality, that you had to question yourself of your own value. There was this sort of looking in the mirror. You did a U-turn. You turned the eyes inside and you sat with that. And then you began to feel, I think, this heartbrokenness that some of our current Dharma teachers talk about, Ruth King, Lama Rod, this idea of being remorseful, being sad, being open. And that is sort of the Leonard Cohen point of, you know, the crack is where the light gets in. And that then continued to propel and fuel your work. You didn't get stuck there, but you did let it permeate you in such a way that you not only were feeling it and reverberating it as empathy does, but they used it from that very sort of soft and overwhelmed place to this place of what the Dalai Lama talks about in terms of compassionate action, that the point of the insight is to actually then take this to move into a place of being able to join and reclaim our humanity of what was taken, which you have called whiteness, and which is this systematized structure, which in mindfulness language is really about causes and conditions. And that if the imprintings from a neuroscience, neurophysiological level around our lower brain, our midbrain, or our limbic brain, you know, sort of our limbic hijack that Tara talks about, when we get into this place of, you know, sort of frozenness or just wanting to defend versus our prefrontal cortex, that we have to learn to be with these different places, know that they're existing so that we can then show up differently with ourselves and others. And to make that initial assumption, I'm a good person, it's not me, how dare you say that, if you were to point it out to me versus me to come to it as on my own, and then doubling down, right? Yeah. And we see this, and that kind of is what people will then come out as white fragility. Or, you know, it'll be like overwhelm and all of that. So I just wanted to kind of sort of...
I love that. Thank you. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I just, because the listeners here, I think, have a bit of a framework. And they'll also say something like, well, we're all love, we're all devotion, we're all about this. And there's sort of this tendency that I see in these communities to sort of say, you know, nobody would say that there's hate. Nobody would say that there's separation. Nobody would say, and I would say, at a fundamental level, at a deep spiritual, cosmic, collective consciousness level, that is true. And it is also true that this system of which you speak, legalized, codified for centuries, is very much one that affects our intergenerational trauma that we inherit as white people of whiteness,
right?
That we then perpetuate harm. And that the whole point of a mindful path is non-harming.
That's right.
You can't do that if you're not aware. And I think your book does that. It teaches us how to be aware because it's like, you got the receipts. Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it. I hate to say that there are so many of them, but you have them.
There are, yeah.
So, I mean, we have maybe about 10 minutes or so left. And I want to, I mean, there's so many things that we could unpack and get into, but is there something specific that you'd like to share and make sure that listeners get to?
Yeah, well, I'd love for folks to understand just how significant this legal policy imposition of whiteness has been literally from the founding of this nation throughout its history. So if I can, if you don't mind, I can give a couple examples.
Please do.
Yeah. Help people see. And again, there are thousands of these, and I'm just going to highlight a couple. I already talked about the law. The naturalization law of 1790 required you be white to naturalize. For 150 years, conferring advantage to those seen as white, giving them access to citizenship and therefore a political voice, right? Huge. Not only that, but that one law, the naturalization law of 1790, it was used as support for major legal decisions like Dred Scott, where our Supreme Court said people of African descent are, in fact, even if you're born here, are not citizens of this country because the founders never intended them to be. It influenced the passage of countless other laws that required white people be in managerial positions relative to melanated people. And alien land laws, which were laws passed that prohibited people. Here's the language, right? Because it loses the racial clue. Those who are ineligible for naturalization, it made it illegal for them to own land. And then a year later to even rent land. And so it was a way of saying non-white people, but they didn't have to say it. So That's just one law. So let me shift to the 1950s when the Housing Act was passed. This devoted billions of dollars to the construction of homes. Our nation had more people than homes. And the law required that in order to access these funds, the developer, if they were building any houses that would be sold to a white person, the entire development was required by law and policy to be white only. So we racially segregated our country even more than it already was by virtue of this law and policy. Furthermore, the Housing Act also required that there were some funds made available for construction of homes for non-white people. And the amount of money given for a house for a white person was more than the money given for each house for melaninated people. Mm. And so we're still living with, even though now those racially unequal policies and laws have been removed, the consequences of those laws continues to promote economic inequality today. Why? Because substandard housing construction hasn't increased in value at the rate that better quality, housing construction has. And so people are realizing increased home value, and that persists today. So even though we remove these laws, they continue to produce inequality on the basis of one's race. And then let's jump to the Highway Act in the 1960s, where the billions of dollars was devoted to the construction of, in the 1950s rather, of the highway system. Mm-hmm. And disproportionately across this country, well-established neighborhoods of people, of Black and brown people actually disproportionately, were plowed through. Not well-established neighborhoods owned by white people, but well-established and many middle-class neighborhoods of people of African descent and Latinx across this country plowed through for the construction of our interstate system. Again, these were built-in features. And so lots of people say to me, well, you know, Dr. Badalora, you're... some of my students will say, you know, we're talking about all these laws that are now removed from the books. But here's what's important. Because we have only removed the law that created the original inequality, right, and we have not addressed reparations.
Right. It's one thing to take away, like, getting punched in the nose. It's another thing to give someone some gauze and some medicine so that it heals.
Exactly. Because what I like to say is, look, imagine we're playing the game of Monopoly, and I get to go around 10 times before you're allowed to move, right? You're just stuck on a piece of property. And by the way, every time it's your turn, even though you can't roll because the law doesn't let you roll, you have to pay me a little bit because I own it.
Jones did a piece on that.
Yeah, so I get to go around 10 times and now you get to play. Right. It's all equal now, right? Everything's fair. It's ridiculous. Of course it's not. And that inequality that the initial prohibition created...
The wealth inequality.
Absolutely. And it's not even... I mean, the wealth inequality is probably the most... obvious, right? We can most easily get to that. But you think about all the other inequalities of self-esteem, of life choices, right? All of protection and lack thereof, things that we're seeing play out in front of us right now.
Right. And I, as you're saying all of this, I'm thinking about the housing thing. That's why I was just focusing on the economics, because that's, of course, the whole driver, which again, from a mindfulness perspective, when we talk about when the Buddhist teaching is there's suffering and there's a cause of suffering, and the cause of suffering is greed, hatred, and delusion. And there's the recognition of that. And then the path out is to be mindful, which includes the ethical path and the path of virtue and the path of reclaiming humanity and actually having a framework for that. And so this is an invitation to actually apply some of these teachings in real life. But this idea of you know, greed is the economic piece, I think, that even started this whole mess, which, you know, is part of it. And to that end, I look at people like the Bradens, I believe Carl and Ann Braden, who are the ones who were actually some of the white allies, if you will, in you know, maybe 50 years ago or something like that, that I believe bought a house and gave it to a Black family, or not gave it to, but sold it to. And that, you know, in contrast to what, for example, you're, you know, saying, like, in a way to subvert.
Yep.
And that they were then penalized for that. Yep. And that the family was essentially, I think, driven out.
Yep.
So it's not like there's no allies. There's not like, and you know, this is just for folks that, you know, take heart. There are, you know, there are people out there who've been fighting, who are white, you know, inheritors of whatever you want to call it, European descended, you know, folks, whatever that means. And there are those who became white. But even in my case, my Italian family, I was just reading for the first time the other day about the lynching of 11, nearly a dozen Italians in New Orleans.
Yeah,
back in the late 1800s, because at that time they were not seen as white. And so this whole understanding that you help bring through your research, through your work, through your teaching, I think is so critical, because I don't think it's the complete picture. What happened with you, that heart shift, that aha moment, if I could sort of have an invitation for the world, right? I would hope that it would happen for everyone, and that there would be some recognition there that, like, there's something wrong here and broken here, and that it also is something that can be healed and repaired.
Absolutely. I guess before we end, I want to just affirm to people, especially those who have been labeled white from the moment of their birth, that we're not stuck, that we have been born into a society that is deeply embedded in white supremacy, and it does damage us, but we can heal and grow and be able to become people who are labeled white, who can have genuine relationships with people who are melaninated. Am I saying that right? I'm laughing.
Melanated. It doesn't matter. Black people. Just say Black people, BIPOC, people of color, AAPI. It doesn't matter. People who are non-white.
Yeah.
Whatever that means. I don't like using race, even though I know I have to, because I know it's a construct. And so I tend to use ethnicity when possible, or I tend to use, you know, whatever the person's identifier or, you know, whatever. But for the purposes of this conversation, because that's how people constructed the division and the separation around, you know, skin pigmentation, that was their deciding factor. That's why I say sometimes the melanation.
I'm like, it's just mumbling.
It's an extra syllable. It's okay. It's all good. It's all, no, you're good. Please. I mean, if you get another degree, we would have no letters left in the alphabet. Okay. So again, the book is Birth of a White Nation, The Invention of White People and Its Relevance Today. Dr. Jacqueline Battalora, Jackie Battalora, is our guest here on Rerooted. And you can learn more about her just by Googling or JacquelineBattalora.com. And her second edition of this book is coming out by Routledge in the next year. And she continues to teach today. And I just wanted to really extend my gratitude to you for sharing your wisdom, your insight, your personal stories, your empathy, and just for staying in the I don't want to say staying in the fight, because even that is imperialist language. Staying on the path.
Yeah, thank you. I love that.
Thank you. Take good care.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, Give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.